So Justin's the new king of Babylon.
So the cub caught the lion's prey.
So, even though you'd like to rest on your laurels, secure in your position of power, now you know they're snapping at your heels and you're going to have to run faster and faster.
So why don't you pass the fucking sugar?
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast. Each week we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show to find out if it still holds up 17 years later. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
This episode is called The King of Babylon.
It first aired in the U.S. on April 29th, 2001, and worldwide on May 14th, 2001.
It was directed by our favorite music video director, Russell Mulcahy, who directed five episodes this season, including the first four.
The King of Babylon was written by Jason Schaefer and Jonathan Tollins. This duo also wrote a good portion of the first season, either individually or as a duo. And I really think that these two writers, plus Russell Mulcahy, is sort of the
dream team.
They are the dream team. They are the Holy Trinity. They are the they are the team that I think pulls out some of the best episodes we've seen in season one.
It turns everything into a music video that just never stops from the intro all the way to the end. So we like these guys and we're very happy to be talking about this episode tonight, which is Who Will Be Crowned King of Babylon? An innocent trip to the mall lands Vic in jail. Brian is beaten at his own game. That's a pretty weak synopsis, but this was a little bit of a lightweight episode. Very funny, really interesting, lots of music, lots of hunky naked men.
And very stylized. Like, that's something that I really want to get into as we talk about the episode, is how it stood out from the more grounded realism of other episodes.
Yeah, that's something that we get a lot in this series, is many different directors and a lot of different visual styles, which is unique. Normally you'll have a serial show where they try to keep the same visual and stylistic cues throughout the entire series. But with Queer as Folk in the first season, we've had so many different directors, so many different writers. It's a little bit of a mess, but it's also kind of why I like the first season the most. The themes in this episode that I jotted down start with jealousy. We have Brian and Justin and their jealousy, Michael and Dr. David and their jealousy, Ted and Emmett and their jealousy. There was also a lot of lines about ageism here, about older people losing their gay luster, and the Vic storyline leads us into legal problems of bathroom cruising and public sex. So I think that really encompasses what the entire episode was about.
Yeah, I think also, I mean, and this ties into the jealousy themes that you're talking about, is there's also the games we play with each other and how those can come in. Either we can win or lose.
As long as they're set to music.
As long as they're set to music. Yeah,
there's quick something, cuts and hunky men in the background.
There's something to these of those kinds of layers that have come throughout this episode that really tie to the jealousy you're talking about.
The episode starts out with a King of Babylon photo shoot, which I believe the model was Angel Escobar, King of Babylon last year.
Angel Escobar, 5'10", 175, 28-inch waist, 9-inch cock, and a birthmark in the shape of Placido Domingo in his inner right thigh.
As a photographer myself, I liked this cute little intro because it was just so over the top for a photo shoot.
Ready? You are so damn hot.
Big clap to that lift. Big clap to it. Go on. Fuck it. That's it.
The photographer is rolling around on the ground. He's praising the model the way Platon does when he's shooting. He has a cute British accent, and the model is just working it in his ermine cape and his crown. It was pretty funny. It was a nice little intro to the King of Babylon is like the prom or the homecoming of gay Pittsburgh society every year.
Yeah, I have a lot of questions about this contest, because it seems to be a thing on Liberty Avenue that everyone attends this contest, whether to participate and or watch the judging. So I'm very curious to know a lot about the criteria of the contest.
Anybody can enter. You just like, sign up.
Yeah. I'm like, who's judging? Who chooses the contestants? What are they judged on? What platforms do the contestants stand for? How will they use their reign to better the community of Babylon? I would like to see if my questions get answered throughout the episode.
I don't think they do, because it appears that in order to enter the contest, you just need to be present to win. And you don't really have an act other than jumping around on stage and taking your clothes off. So I'm okay with that contest. It reminds me of like the wet boxers contest that a bar called Roscoe's in Chicago used to have. Do they still have that?
I don't think so. It reminds me of when Spin, which was also a bar
the
in Chicago.
The shower contest.
The shower contest. The yes. Midnight shower contest, which I watched approximately once.
Oh, I was a regular.
At Spin for Dollar Drink Night?
Dollar drinks, dollar people.
It was more like 75 cents when I went. So, but yeah, let's check out what's going on with this contest and the excitement that's building to it.
Well, after the photo shoot, there was a very clever transition between a picture of who we think is Angel Escobar, the winner, as Ted will fill us in on, pulls away to a poster. And of course, Debbie's got a put her little mark on the poster, just like she did for the whatever the International Mr. Leather event was. The Leather Ball, I think they called it. Mm-hmm. Before, Debbie has to announce all of these events at Babylon. She has to be the town crier for them.
Hear ye, hear ye.
So, of course, everybody's at the diner, and Blake is there. He's the new one. And everybody's throwing shade at him in one way or another. Almost the same way that they did to Justin when Justin was the first outsider that joined that little gang.
Yeah, I feel like they actually are like a fraternity, and this is the hazing ritual they go through. So it makes me wonder that, like, did it start with Brian and Michael, and then, say, Ted came on board, and then Emmett came on board, and they all kind of treat each other the same way? And so, because Blake is new, hi, we know you're new to the group. We're going to treat you like shit.
Such bitchy gays, I tell you.
Whew.
Emmett has this really cute double entendre line. Let's listen to that real quick.
God, who would do that?
Who wouldn't fuck Brian?
No. I mean, strip in front of all those people.
For $1,000 and a trip to the Bahamas? A lot of guys.
Especially when you're on drugs. Please, you'll do anything. Oops. Sorry.
That was pointed right at Blake.
Like,
Emmett kind of covers it up with present company excluded.
Well, and it shows a great parallel that much like the relationship dynamics that existed between Brian, Justin, and Michael, we now see Emmett in the Michael role. And I guess it would be Blake in the Justin role and Ted in the Brian role?
Wow, who's on first?
Like,
it's more like who's on bottom?
I think Emmett and or Blake. But yeah, so I find that interesting that they've shifted that dynamic so that we can kind of see that storyline that that was introduced into the beginning of the series is now playing out within the friend group, but just with different people. So it's been fun to watch that evolution.
Brian makes a funny joke about Dr. David. That reminded me that Dr. David wasn't in the last episode, was he? The last one
was
Good Grief, and that was mostly
not
about Brian's dad.
I think it was such a focus on Brian that Dr. David came. Maybe Chris Potter just wasn't available for shoot.
He was on a Law and Order Dick Wolf show that week. So we're quickly back to Dr. David's architecturally perfect mid-century modern house. The good doctor is doing laundry in his tight old faded jeans that look suspiciously close to a pair of diesel jeans that I bought yesterday for Christmas.
And they also have a noticeably have been ripped a little bit in the inner thigh by the left buttock.
Wait, were they ripped in this scene? Because we find out that they're ripped as soon as they get to Babylon in a minute. But I don't remember them being ripped here. I thought it was a costume gaffe.
I'm pretty sure they were ripped because as he was bent over looking very good in those jeans, I was paying very close attention for this podcast so we can appropriately
examine it.
Yes.
Examine and comment. Dr. David claims that he's too old for that shit.
You feel like going out? Tonight's the King of Babylon contest.
Oh, Michael, I'm too old for that shit.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
Look, If the guys saw how incredibly sexy you look in those jeans, they'd probably stop,
What?
Nothing. Never mind. I should have said anything.
No. Finish what you were going to say.
I bet they'd stop making jokes about adult diapers and denture cream and penile implants.
How old do you think Dr. David is?
He's in his early 40s.
How do you know that?
That is my best estimate. Okay. But I feel like that's what tracks with him having...
his own chiropractic
it's his marital history and his son that... So I feel like we were given that... there's a timeline around that time where it laid out what his age was. So I think he's in his early 40s. So he's...
You mentioned Dr. David's son without mentioning JT.
Which, total side note, I have since watched all four seasons of Degrassi Next Class. And I actually would be... I would be 100% down for expanding a podcast on that show alone because it was fantastic.
It was great. Loved it.
But I digress. Since Michael has dated Dr. David Cameron, that age has always been a fucking joke with them, and that he is this ancient old, like, they treat him like he's the crypt keeper. I'm like, he's literally like maybe 10 or 11 years older than you. Calm the hell down.
But I think the positions in life are significantly different, where he has the architecturally perfect mid-century modern house. Michael was living in a tenement building with Emmett after Emmett's roommate, the drag queen, burned down their old place. So having that station in life almost extends the ages quite a bit, to the point of where it doesn't matter so much that the person might be 2 years older, 1 year older, 4 years, 10 years older, the way that Dr. David is. If they're like so far advanced in life that you don't have anything in common, I think that's where some of the issues start to creep in. And that's something that the show had been working on a little bit with Michael and Dr. David. For instance, when Michael set up all of his toys and Dr. David was commenting about the house was architecturally designed to function together.
I think it's just because Dr. David Cameron has managed to keep his life. I think it's because he had such control over his life,
he's an achiever.
Yeah, that he has achieved something of a small amount of wealth, and he has
a child.
A child. Cabin. He has other
abs
and a chest and ass. That,
speaking of his ass, we get to Babylon, and Dr. David has this awkward blocking move where he just spins around for no apparent reason other than to show the gang his ass. It wasn't on purpose. It was just bad directing. Russell, come on.
But wait, did he show his ass? Because I remember right before this moment that he lifted his shirt to go like, do I still have it? And I was like, yes, you still got it.
Yeah, that was back at the...
Yes, he lifted it up and we saw those abs and I was just like, hello.
But on the steps of Babylon, he just turns around for no reason and gets Emmett's attention.
No, I think what it is, you know, I mean, I do this all the time when I'm like with friends. It's like you're like looking around to see who else is around. So I think there was like an editing thing where it's like, oh, he turned around. What is it that's catching everyone's eye? It's Dr. David Cameron's perfect ass and those jeans. Because that's the key to this, is it those jeans that are what catching his attention.
His ass was nothing, though. It was pretty regular. It wasn't...
Lies and vicious rumors, Patrick.
I didn't see this phenomenal ass. I saw, like, dad bod with dad butt.
Bullshit. I don't need your jealousy for Dr. David Cameron to seep into what we talk about later on in this episode.
I'll remind you again that you were in Team Blake for a very long time, and look where that got you.
Ted is in love with the man who is getting his life together. So we move on to inside Babylon, and once again, everyone is sort of giving shade and shit to Ted and especially Blake.
Yeah, it was like that same old like receiving line thing that we've seen before, mm-hmm. where everybody lines up to get their dig in. Everybody has to have a line there. They all walk past Ted and Ted's like, can I buy everybody around? And everybody's like, no. I kept walking past him. Everybody had to have a shot. I think in the last time we talked about it, you called it the punch the woman scene in Airplane.
Yes, everyone needs a hit. That's exactly right. What it is.
This was a great intro to the night that was going to occupy us. I don't think we really left Babylon too much except for to go to the police station. We'll get to that in a second.
Right.
But there's dancers. There's confetti falling out of the sky. I wish that happened more often.
This King of Babylon is a big deal.
Ted looks furious that everybody's just pawning him off, and then the dealer shows up.
Yes, you know, and you know, they make a very pointed moment to say, like, oh, this is going to have an effect on Blake.
Yeah, it was one of those casting choices that we've used this term before, where you see him and he is, in air quotes, dealer. He's just like central casting, right there. Dealer. Yep. I just can't believe that Ted is actually falling for this Crystal Queen saying that he's clean every time. Ted is an accountant. We know him to have an MBA. We know him to have a undergrad in finance. And yet he can't figure out that a Crystal Queen saying that he's clean is lying.
Emmett makes a point in the when he confronts Blake in the previous episode that it's quite possible that Ted is still rather naive about it, and that he's being blinded by the infatuation and the chemistry between the two of them. He's gonna be willingly go along and believe him.
He's suspending his own disbelief.
Yeah,
I could see that. So let's talk about the King of Babylon contest. It gets a little crazy in this episode, so let's break this out into sections, and let's first talk about the contest up to a point, and then talk about some of the couple interactions that we had going on.
Yes.
Contestant number one, well first, the Queen of Babylon arrives, and
Sheba.
Sheba?
She trips on her way up to the stage, which I thought was really fucking funny, and I wanted to know if that was a moment that was scripted, or if that just sort of happened, and they kept rolling with it, and that's where we got that really great line about the royal tits.
Yeah, are the royal tits intact?
Gotta make sure the royal tits are intact. All right, boys, go away. Go play with yourselves. Cha-chow.
It had that kind of nice Coming to America feel to it.
Oh, my God.
Do you know who played the Queen of Babylon? Do we know anything about her?
No. I did look up the actor, though. And so I was curious to know if it was... if he was a drag queen.
Yeah, or just playing one.
Yeah, or just playing one. So from what I could see, this is still just playing a part, as it were.
Salvatore Antonio is the actor.
Yeah. I think he's just hired. He was hired for the day.
He's a day player.
Yeah,
he's a day player. He's still acting, though. He's got an awful lot of credits, even in 2017.
Oh, that's impressive.
He was on Saving Hope as a nurse. We're going to have to reach out to him. Let's tweet to him afterwards.
Yes, and say, like, Sheba,
are the royal tits still intact? So, contestant number one, and I also noticed that this was a very diverse group of contestants in the Queen of Babylon, King of Babylon contest. So, contestant number one, white male, was Four Alarm Fred, who is in full fireman garb as he makes his way to the stage. I think this is like a stripping contest because he's up there in his fireman outfit, and pretty quickly it's off. And I remember, like, way back in the day in Chicago, there was a bar called Cocktail that used to have, quote, dancers. It wasn't quite to, like, Lucky Horseshoe Chicago level, but they would have dancers there. And there was always a guy there that did a fireman routine. And so I didn't know that firemen were this kind of sort of gay thing that everybody is into, or what?
It's the uniform, Patrick. You can't say no to a man in uniform. That's why the next contestant is a cop.
Black man, contestant number two, Officer O'Reilly, who is very arresting.
Some of these puns, or some of these play on words, were really, like, very easy.
Yeah, the writing was very lightweight, and it was nice to have a lightweight episode that we could just kind of coast through and enjoy and have some fun with.
Right, especially considering the last episode was about death.
Contestant number three is a Middle Eastern man, Muhammad, who is a yoga instructor from Rip Gym, who can perform auto fellatio. Contestant number four was a black man named Dwayne, who prefers men in leather. Contestant number five is Pittsburgh's hunkiest chiropractor, Dr. David.
Our next contestant likes younger men. His favorite pastime is feeling superior. His special skill is manipulating people.
Must be you.
Let's put our hands together for Pittsburgh's hunkiest chiropractor, Dr. David Cameron.
He was entered into the contest by Brian after a little back and forth that we'll talk about in a few minutes because it was really, really good. Michael was entirely opposed to Dr. David being in the contest. And he had these like really kind of mean lines for his hunky chiropractor husband.
You don't have to go up there.
Dr. Cameron!
I have no intention of it.
Thank God. You wouldn't want to make a fool of yourself dancing around in your underwear at your age.
And I was like, whoa. Yeah. Watch yourself, Michael.
This was like bratty Michael. Michael has these bratty moments that come out every once in a while. And this was one of them.
And I love that Dr. David Cameron's like, oh, at my age. And he goes up there.
Well, he thought about it first. He was like, there's no way I'm going up there. No way, no way, no way. And then it was because of what Michael had said that kind of propelled him onto stage almost. He wasn't going to do it at first on his own, but then after his little boy toy says, oh, you're too old for that, he's like, no, no, I'm not. And then he's up there on stage all
right.
of a sudden.
Right. Because, like, it's his man saying that. And so now he's like, oh, that's what you think of me? Let me show you.
There is one thing I noticed as Dr. David is taking his clothes off on stage is that there's this little twink in the front row that steals Dr. David's plaid shirt.
He was playing like a little tug of war with it. It was pretty great. I was very into Dr. David Cameron's improvised routine.
Even when he just grabs his t-shirt and just rips it right open.
Oh, that's where I was like, and my vote is cast. Ooh. Let me have a
Michael couldn't even watch this. He turned around and was not even looking at the stage while this was going on. And he was missing a good show. At one point, Dr. David stuck his hands down his pants and fluffed up and then just dropped his pants right there, right on stage. And the little twink in the front row is reaching up and like getting a feel. And Dr. David's like, oh, no, no, a little too far.
Right. Because I think the little twink grabbed his ass, great ass. And he's like, oh, no, no, no. And I was like, oh, God, Dr. David Cameron, you're such a tease.
The music with this scene was really good. It was Song 2 by Blur, and it was a dance remix of it, kind of like what you'd hear at maybe a spin class. So it was a really tuned up version of it, but it really worked. And David gets off stage, and then Michael goes right into Mama Bear mode and drags him away.
Well, and he's doing that because as Dr. David Cameron is working his way through the crowd, everyone is throwing their cards and paper at him to give his numbers. And Michael grabs the bunch of them and just rips them up.
He's like, you're hot. Call me anytime.
I was here for every second of that scene.
We'll be right back with more Still Queer As Folk. In the meantime, if you're enjoying the show, please click that subscribe button. It's free and means a lot to us. Thanks. I think our A story is Brian and Justin here. Justin is talking to Brian and commenting about how all the old folks at the club are partying way past their prime. And it seemed like a direct poke at Brian. And I couldn't figure out why he would do that. There wasn't any motivation to it at that time. But then he tries to lure him out of Babylon with his Twinkie powers. So it was just kind of weird. And Brian says, check back in an hour. And we realize that Justin's Brian's backup for the night, which isn't anything that's all that unusual. This one was just demonstrated a lot more. But why was Brian suddenly pushing Justin away like that? In episodes preceding this, we had started to see that Brian and Justin were becoming more traditional couple.
Perfect example when they were sitting through that god-awful slideshow of Michael and Dr. David Cameron's trip to Paris. They were just sitting there all cuddly and like, oh, it's romantic. They're like acting like a couple.
Yeah.
And so it just seemed like for the journey of this particular episode, let's insert the conflict of we're not a couple. You're a fucking couple, Brian.
Do you think it had anything to do with his dad dying like in the last episode? It doesn't seem to, but
I don't think it does. Cause like, I feel like this episode as a whole, because of its stylistic changes from previous episodes, sort of stands on its own. So I didn't see a lot of connection to the previous episodes.
Yeah, this really was standalone. It was mostly in Babylon. Following Brian and Justin's adventure, Brian tells Justin to check back in an hour. And then 52 minutes later, Justin's checking back in with him. Brian just kind of brushes him off again. And once again, I didn't understand why that was happening. other than, like, as you said, to just kind of create this drama going on. Justin catches sight of Brian cruising this guy that they had talked about earlier that Justin claimed had ass acne, a tragic endowment, and just getting over a really bad case of gonorrhea. And then Brian goes right for him.
Right, because I mean, clearly, I mean, it's
he's the one.
I'm going to assume that that is not true.
everything you think it's just Justin a play said, by Justin to keep him away?
God, yes. I'm going to be like, Justin, you don't know a damn thing. You see that that is exactly who Brian is going to go for. So let me try and like dissuade him, which it's kind of like how, you know, when you tell something, you tell like a little kid, like, no, you can't have that. That just makes them want it more.
Right.
It's going to have the opposite effect. So and that's exactly what happens. Brian's like, great, target acquired. And I'm going to do everything I can to try and get that guy to sit on my dick.
Justin is so appalled by everything that's going on that he seeks out the advice of the Queen of Babylon.
This guy, ain't it always?
So what did this guy do?
He takes me for granted.
A walking wet dream like you could have anyone he wants.
I know. It's the part I find so irritating.
Maybe he needs to know it. Maybe everybody needs to know it.
Well, there is the ego boost that Justin needs to try and compete with Dream Boy. That's what's on the
boy's shirt. Oh, is that what it said?
It said Dream Boy.
Oh, my God. The best way to do that at the moment was to enter the King of Babylon contest, which he does.
The next contestant loves the Powerpuff Girls, margaritas, and older men who take him for granted. Here's Justin!
And his intro was kind of funny, but I didn't understand the first part. Maybe you can explain this to me.
Sure.
Sheba says he loves the Powerpuff Girls. What is that?
You never heard of the Powerpuff Girls?
No.
So it's an animated series on Cartoon Network about three little girls that were genetically engineered by a scientist that are also superheroes. Oh my gosh, Patrick. Your mind is about to be blown.
This makes sense because I've heard the term Powerpuff Bottoms before.
This is most certainly not the same thing. Here, I'll give you, this is the IMDb synopsis for it. Three superpowered little girls constantly save the world, or at least the city of Townsville, from monsters, would-be conquerors, and a few other gross things.
Wow, that's really obscure to drop into a Chris
Oh, it's really
Hogue
not
episode.
Obscure. I mean, it was on for years.
Wow.
They had almost 80 episodes of Powerpuff Girls and a movie. Ooh. And they recently brought it back. So.
Future podcast.
Powerpuff. Oh, I wouldn't be mad about that either. But no. So
what did it? So do you I think it meant that Justin liked them.
Oh, I think he's just speaking to how young he was.
Okay.
Because it's like a Saturday morning cartoon kind of feel.
Got it.
But I also think that Sheba made up the intros for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, like most drag queens, it's an awful lot of improv. For the rest of it, she had it right, where she said that he also likes margaritas, which we saw him throwing those back with Melanie.
That's true. And then, of course, older men who take him for granted.
Who could that be?
I wonder.
Did you notice when he's about to jump on stage, he pulled his tank over his head and then it had this long fringe?
Yes. Where did this costume change happen?
Well, he had the tank on. I didn't know it had fringe.
That's why I thought he was wearing something completely different. It like threw me off.
He grabbed the nearest cowboy hat and jumped on stage.
And he rode him cowboy.
Everybody hears his name, so everybody's turning around to get a good look. There were three different reactions that I saw, though. Ted seemed appalled. He was like, oh, no, what is he doing up there? Evan and Michael were rooting him on. And
even Michael was cheering for him, which I found really funny.
Right. Maybe he realized that it was going to take a little slice of Brian's skin off. So maybe
that's what I think it was. I think Michael's like, oh, this is going to burn Brian and it's just going to be fun.
And Brian's trick, the Dream Boy, just couldn't take his eyes off of Justin. Did you notice also that Justin suddenly can dance on a pole?
You would have thought he was working at Lucky Horseshoe. Like, geez.
They don't have a pole there.
They don't? I could have sworn they do.
I don't think so.
I've only been there once, Patrick.
There's not one in the front. There's not one in the back. Maybe there's one in the way back. Maybe that's the one that you're thinking of.
Maybe.
It's the first place that I've had wine out of a hose before. Now it comes out of a bottle. It used to come out of a hose.
Wow. Only the best for Patrick here.
Yes, yes. Tonight we're drinking wine out of a box, so what difference does it make? Justin, after he starts his little pole dancing routine, his pants come all the way off, and we get a very nice underwear check of the young teenager.
So at first, I didn't know how I felt about these briefs.
They were Levi's.
They were Levi's. Okay, I didn't pause.
Does Levi's make briefs?
I don't know.
That was news to me.
I thought they were like two exists or something, but I didn't pause the scene to catch the actual brand.
I did.
But Levi's, hon, you know what?
This is why,
this is why Google exists.
The song that was playing here was called High School Confidential by Carol Pope. It was a great song for Justin because he is obviously still in high school. So the whole song is just the chorus of it is high school, high school, high school, over and over and over. It really let Justin show his teeny bopper skills, as well as drive home who this character was on stage, because we didn't know that he was a pole dancer and we didn't know that he had a
cowboy hat. No, that was a skill set not shared with us previously.
So sticking with Justin's performance, he becomes the new king of Babylon, complete with the crown. He also won $1,000 and a trip to the Bahamas that we never hear about.
I like, does he ever go on this trip?
I don't think so.
maybe in his because of his WASP heritage, he's had so many trips to the Bahamas that he could care less.
So after Justin wins, he's making his way through the crowd, comes up to Brian and his trick, and Brian's still being catty to him because I think Brian realizes that Justin did this just to entertain him. And Brian's trick is totally into Justin instead of Brian. Justin set it out as his goal to steal that trick away from him.
It's so good, it has to be fattening. Watching the trick like saunter over to Justin, the new king of Babylon, and then the trick calls Brian old.
Yeah, it was shot so well. It was shot and cast well because you see an obvious difference between the two. You see fresh-faced Justin in his Levi briefs that probably Jennifer Taylor bought, folded, and washed and laundered for him many times. And you see Brian, who is looking, I don't know if they just did him up a little bit differently, but he looked very old.
He looked haggard.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
So Justin takes off with the trick. They head into the grotto, the back room. And Brian's skulking around Babylon just looking for Justin and the trick. And eventually he finds them down in the back room. And Justin is topping this guy.
Like hard.
I love it when Justin gets all toppy. Have we seen him top before? It's sort of implied that he did in the museum, but I don't think it's ever been so overt.
That's the moment where I'm just going with the idea that it is implied that he has some versatile skills.
He looks like a good top.
Yeah, he looked like he knew what he was doing.
Yeah. The music that was playing there was called You Look So Fine by Garbage, which made a good connection between Brian looking for Justin and finding him just banging the shit out of this guy that he had tried to get with before, that previously Justin said had ass acne. And gonorrhea. I like how that comes full circle. Meanwhile, Dr. David is still prancing around the club. After his performance,
he is living his best life, and I'm like, you go, Dr. David Cameron, you tell them who's old. It was awesome.
Michael's just lecturing him though the whole time. It was funny.
I'm like, yeah, now who's the old person?
You're right.
He's all bitchy about it.
And then they get back to the architecturally perfect mid-century modern house, and we have only like a minute or two there. And then Dr. David strips for Michael again. This was so funny. I really liked it. There's one thing that I left out when Dr. David was entering the contest, and that was his back and forth between him and Brian. And Dr. David had this long lecture. Let's listen to it for a minute.
The problem with this contest is that it exposes the single most tragic flaw of gay culture.
Exposes a lot more than that, Doc.
And that is our almost pathological obsession with youth, beauty, and smooth, muscular bodies.
I know, what a shame.
And until we break free of our stunted adolescence and our superficial values, we'll always be boys, never men.
God, is that all?
And then Brian comes back with this scorching rebuttal.
I happen to find what David is saying to be profoundly insightful.
I find it to be profoundly full of shit.
an opinion put forth as truth by a bunch of hypocritical, jealous, guilt-ridden, self-loathing, middle-aged, sexually frustrated, pseudo-intellectual fags who wish they were straight.
But who was Dr. David really talking to originally? He just seemed to bust that out of nowhere.
Well, no, he's calling out that group because, you know, they think because he is older than them that, you know, he doesn't have a place in the gay world anymore.
But isn't he calling out Michael as kind of part of that, though? Because it was just Michael and Brian.
Because Michael is. Yeah, he is. I think Dr. David Cameron has no problem calling Michael out on his bullshit, too. Because remember, Michael even called him old. So you don't want to be, you know, when he said you don't want to be dancing around there at your age, he's like, no, you think that because it's all about these youthful good looks and the six pack abs, that those are the only gay people that matter in this world. And he's calling that as bullshit.
Do you think that the whole thing was really just trying to take on Brian because of previous episodes where we have seen him fighting over Michael?
Yeah, well, I think partially because I remember he was ready to not do it until Michael made his comment. So he's like, wait a minute, even you think this? The person that I am currently spending my life with? Okay, I got to show you something. That's how I interpreted the moment to be. That this is a moment for Dr. David Cameron to show that he's not this old biddy that they think he is.
I did like that the Brian of old was back all of a sudden. For the past several episodes, they seem to have been softening him up a little bit and making him a little more approachable and nice and kind of like the guy that you really want to be with. Now he just came back with just like dickhead lines. Liked it, but it just seemed out of order. It's like, I don't know why this is coming back through here.
Well, I think because now that he's gone through the death of his father, he's able to start to build himself back up.
Yeah, he can become more of a dick.
Exactly. He's like a snake. You know how they shed their skin and you come back stronger? I think that's what happened here.
Meanwhile, Ted and Blake, let's talk about these two. Blake suddenly announces that he has to go to the toilet. And so he heads down there and runs into Dealer, who offers him this huge bag of crystal meth.
That was a lot of drugs in that bag.
It was. Ted is just kind of lurking outside of the bathroom.
Well, and the only reason he does that is because everyone else, or at least Emmett, has told him, oh, you think you can trust him? You know what he's doing.
Yeah, so they put that disbelief into Ted, so. Yeah.
So I think, well, and I think it's like, it's partially because of the doubt that they put in his head, but also I think he was also very over getting the constant bullshit from them about Blake.
It wasn't bullshit, though. They were truth-telling.
Well, no, but like that, they can't seem to trust him, which is fair, but degrading what Blake means to Ted. So they're also being very disrespectful to how Ted is feeling, not just that Blake is an easy target.
Yeah, and Ted really drew the line when he was talking about if his friends have a problem with the Crystal Queen, that they were never friends in the first place. That was a little bit creepy to me because it almost seemed as if Ted was becoming an addict as well, where he was eschewing his close friends in favor of this new guy. I just thought that line was very, very harsh.
It shows that he is getting attached very quickly. I will say that.
Yeah, and to the point of where he was just going to dismiss his friends, and they were just trying to help him and save him.
It all comes down to the approach, I think, because we see later on in the episode when we get to Emmett's tryst and he's introduced to the group, that everyone just seems to just accept this guy that Emmett met 25 minutes ago with open arms. And that's what set Ted off, is that these people have now had opportunity to be around Blake. Like, we know that they've had interaction with him in the group setting before now, and they still are weary of him, giving him shit, like knocking him out, like knocking him down, which he is in a vulnerable, Blake is in a very vulnerable, susceptible place. Yeah. So if they say, oh, you're an addict and you're always going to be an addict, and you should just, you know, like, that's not going to help him in any way.
But I don't think they wanted to help Blake. I think they wanted to keep him away from innocent Ted, who wasn't quite as worldwise as some of the other ones. It just seemed weird that Ted was so willing to give up his closest friends for the drug addict so quickly. And again, it's like the sum total of their relationship was GHB, coma, hospital.
But, well, and again, those are like the major moments, but we've also seen the moments where Blake cooked for Ted, made him this nice meal, kept up the home.
That was one meal, though.
I mean, okay, we're not seeing everything, though. So, but we are
maybe
getting
that's
taste.
It. Maybe I needed to see more to understand why Ted was being
but,
so.
You know, again, these episodes are only an hour long. Like they have to show enough to get the point across. Not every episode is going to be able to show every second of their lives. We have to go on what Ted has experienced, what he brings to the table, and saying like, well, he's done all of these things. So.
But they can fill in some of the blanks. Yeah. A 2 or 3 second line talking about something that draws the two characters closer together helps us with the story. Being willing to discard your 4 closest friends for one guy for no apparent reason doesn't carry the story enough for me. Well, I just need a little bit more to understand what Ted's motivation is there. So if we knew that, enough time had passed, like, you know, it's been 6 months and he's been clean and they've been living together and they went to the country, they borrowed Dr. David's house or whatever.
Okay. Well,
then I think that line could carry it. But then, if one of my friends said that they were going to drop me because I was offhand to a crystal queen that suddenly popped up in their life, I would be highly suspicious of this guy. So there's another arc going on that I thought was hilarious, and that's Emmett's little, I wrote it down as inner monologue. It was like another supernatural Emmett moment, like the other time where he was in the Matrix with Use My Whole 27.
This storyline that follows Emmett takes a very sharp departure from the realism that we see in the other story. And it's because, you know, we're discussing like this sort of fairy tale love that Emmett explores, and so they really amp up the style of it by treating it like as if it is a fairy tale, and we're watching Emmett have an entire relationship from first meet to honeymoon phase to struggle to end within an hour and a half.
I thought it was hilarious.
Oh, it was fantastic. It's one of my favorite things in this episode.
I don't know why it was here though.
Well, I think it's because so we have all these other relationships that have developed. And Emmett even comments saying like, oh, it looks like this is going to be a couple's thing because, you know, we have Brian and we have Brian and Justin. We have Michael and Dr. David Cameron, and we have Ted and Blake. So really, Emmett is now the odd man out who is not having any type of relationship. So what they do is they create this story that he is now going to be having this opportunity to fall in love and have a relationship within like the hour and a half that exists of them being at Babylon.
All set to the soundtrack of West Side Story.
Yes. The first meet of Emmett and this guy is done just like Tony and Maria at the gym, complete with the Jerome Robbins choreography. I like immediately had to text you when I saw this and I was like, oh my God, let's break down how they're using at the gym right now. It made me so happy to sell this thing that like it's like love at first sight, you know, which I think is sort of how Emmett has treated most of his relationships. I mean, we do recall his quick romance with Katsu.
Kane.
For a certain amount of Kane. They meet and it's as if like they're gonna have this first beautiful kiss, and then we go to the cave. Oh, and Emmett is just like sucking his life force dry.
That was hilarious.
I was just like, geez, what is Emmett doing to this guy?
I don't know if you noticed it, but at the end, everybody applauds, of course. And there was,
yes, I know exactly what you're talking about.
There was one character on his knees rimming this other guy. He turns around to applaud Emmett. And the guy that was being rimmed reaches around, grabs his head and pushes him back into his butt.
It was such a
Did
small detail.
Did you write that one down too?
Oh, I was dying. I was laughing so hard at that
great
moment.
Great piece of extra casting and directing.
Like, it's one thing that Emmett gave this guy, like apparently the most incredible orgasm he's ever experienced, but that it then encouraged others to stop their sexual proclivities to then applaud, only for his face to get shoved back in the guy's ass was hilarious.
And then it gets turned around where now it's Emmett's turn to get sucked off. Yes. And the same thing happens again.
It's so great.
And I wrote down in my notes, because I was watching this, like, what the hell is going on here? And I wrote down, is Emmett supposed to be hallucinating?
And see, that's
like, did he take mushrooms or something?
No, I think what we're seeing is how this is like us in Emmett's eye. Like, we are experiencing Emmett's life and how he experiences love, which is very quick.
I loved it. And then they come out of the cave, the back room. Mysteriously, everybody's all together at the bar. And Emmett goes to introduce the guy to him, and he doesn't know his name. So,
and we find out his name is Brent. And then Brent doesn't know who Emmett is.
Yeah.
And I think this is what sets Ted off. You know, yeah. As you were saying about how you would be worried about a friend who would drop you for someone. It's like, well, if my friends can't have the decency to be open to someone who, yeah, obviously we know Blake is not perfect. We know that he has had troubles. We have all experienced trouble and trauma and issues in our lives.
We've all passed out on the floor at Babylon at one time.
Okay, that is one issue.
We've all poisoned a trick.
Fuck's sake. Okay, so Blake has made bad decisions in his life. And we know that Ted has as well. We know that Brian has. We know that Michael has. We know
but
that Justin has.
Decisions. Have we seen that?
Watching
yet?
Porn at work is a bad decision, I think. And we know that comes back to bite him in the ass. But so the fact that they're
it
going
also
to,
comes
the,
back to make his career.
But the fact that they're going to continue to hold that against Blake and refuse to believe that he is clean, even though he is, and they just accept Brent with open arms after meeting him within 3 seconds. Like, Blake has spent time with these people. He has had meals with them by now. Like, we know him to be have been integrated in some way with the group. So for Emmett to then show up and say, hi, this is, I'm sorry, what was your name again? And they're all like, hi, any friend of Emmett is a friend of ours. I would be fucking pissed off. And so I understand why Ted probably uses his anger in that moment to convince Blake to not run off. Because I'm sure that that's what Blake is like. You're right. I am no good. I shouldn't be with you. And he probably would have gone and taken drugs if it weren't for Ted.
The thing with addicts, though, when they're integrating with an entirely new group of people, is the burden of proof has to be a lot higher for them because they don't have any background with this group of people. The only thing that these people know is that they poisoned one of the members of their squad there. So I think it's natural that people are going to be skeptical of the guy.
Sure, but I think now he has had ample opportunity to show that he has and is actively working, because he mentions that he is going to, he's going to
meetings at the Gay and Lesbian Center.
Yes, he's going. So he's making an active effort to better himself. And I would be like, that's part of the burden of proof I think you're talking about.
An interesting thing with this particular arc here is that it doesn't seem as if anybody on our squad has experience dealing with addicts. Like, they don't have an addict in the group.
Well, yet. And I think Emmett in the previous episode gave us a hint of that. Because he said, he could recognize that he was talking to a dealer. So I think that's something that Emmett has either seen before or had personal experience with. I totally understand why Emmett would be like the most skeptical.
I don't know. I think if I was in that group of people, I would continually be suspicious of Blake, mostly because I've seen addicts before. Especially crystal addicts, not a whole lot of happy endings there. So
sure, yeah.
I can kind of relate to that, that kind of standoffish behavior between the squad and Blake. I just struggle with Ted's blind acceptance of Blake, ignoring like some of the weirdness that's going on.
Yeah, I would have to say that it could also be tied to Ted still finding himself, because remember, not 2 episodes ago, he was Dale Wexler's suck pig.
Oh yeah.
So I think that could be a part of it as well, that maybe he's working towards finding a kindred spirit, and maybe it is with Blake. And this is also the first time I think we've seen Ted have someone who is this interested and actively working to be interested in him. Like, we could tell that when he was with Roger, that there was no chemistry there. And clearly there is something. There is a strong attraction that both he and Blake have that's building. So,
well, in the last episode, we left off with Blake on the floor of the Tina Towers, right?
Correct. But remember, now he is in meetings and. but back to Emmett and Brent.
They break up.
Yes. Like, I think what happens, Emmett runs out because he smells cologne on Brent. And he says he meets someone. It's like he says they've been together for, what, an hour and 45 minutes? Yeah.
And then all of a sudden they're like in the alley and they have coats on. It's yes. like they just blew through the coat check. I wrote this one up as it was a story of telling that tale of fast and brief relationships that happen so often in the gay community. You fall for somebody really quickly and it's so brief that it becomes meaningless pretty quickly and you forget about it within a day or two. You know, it doesn't have a lot of meat to it, but you've still taken a bite out of it. But that's like kind of where it leaves off. It's just these very, very quick turnarounds.
They're sort of doomed. Like, is that,
yeah, but not right? in like a bad way. You know, you know that it's not going to last, but you just kind of have fun for a while.
So while
let's
all
go
of
cruise
this
at the mall for a bit.
So while all of the drama is going down at the King of Babylon contest,
Vic has to go shopping.
Yes. Vic is shopping at the mall and he goes into the bathroom. And he is joined by someone.
Those urinals, those were just as cruisy as the ones in Brian's office.
At least the ones in Brian's office, I think, had dividers. This was just like...
No, they didn't.
Oh, these were just urinals up against the wall.
Yeah.
And
Vic goes right to the middle. He's an experienced cruiser.
I don't think Vic was there to cruise. He was literally there to go to the bathroom.
He just went there on instinct.
Yeah. And he is joined by someone who is very clearly yanking it, doing the whole, hey, he might as well start foot tapping. And
use the hanky code.
Yeah. And Vic is just like, I'm not going to get into this. I'm not, because he can see what's happening, because we know Vic is undoubtedly an experienced cruiser.
Well, Vic's just old. And he's like, you know, this is a lot of effort. I got my shopping bags. I got to go. Yeah.
Well, he also says that public restrooms are not my scene. But what we find is that he is arrested for indecent exposure.
Call Debbie for help quickly because yes. Debbie knows a lawyer.
And who was that lawyer?
I was really disappointed with Melanie's role in this story. Apparently, they take the phone off the hook at night, so Debbie literally had to go over to the lesbian's house and bang on the door until somebody would open it.
Hold on! Jesus! I'm coming! What's the matter?
I've been calling, but there's no answer.
Oh, we turn the phone off at night. It wakes Gus up.
I'm sorry to be coming by so late. Vic's in jail.
What?
He said he was at the mall. He went to the men's room. And the next thing is they arrested him for indecent exposure.
Indecent exposure?
Yeah, he swears he didn't do anything. But he needs a lawyer, and I didn't know what...
It's okay. I'm going to go get dressed.
Well, if he didn't do anything, why did they arrest him?
It's harassment of gay people. Cops just like playing capture the fag.
What are you saying? You think Vic did something?
I was just asking.
Yeah, well, I'm telling you, I know my own brother. And it's crap.
No, listen, it's going to be okay. I'm going to go get dressed, but we better get move on. I'll be right back.
So Debbie and Mel, who is wearing a turtleneck, by the way. So I...
The blue one?
I am convinced that Emmett is stealing these clothes. they get to the police station. They, you know, want to know how much the bail is. Turns out Vic has a previous arrest for like some sort of drug possession.
Vic, you all yeah. dog you.
Debbie just wants to get his meds to him. Because
it was Debbie's fault that he had a record also. It was Debbie's joint that was in the glove box of the car. And
of course it was.
Vic took the fall for her.
But here, Debbie knows that all I care about is just getting my brother his meds because he should have taken them. And we know that, especially in 2000, the cocktails, I'm sure, were very different. So it was even more important that Vic administer his medication.
Yeah, they all had to be taken on time.
And when Debbie mentions that he's HIV positive, it feels like for the desk sergeant, like everything clicks. Oh, he was arrested for indecent exposure, cruising in a public bathroom. He's HIV positive. He says, figures.
And Melanie's there and she gets wind of that and she's like, excuse me? But for being an attorney, Melanie sure didn't know what was going on or what to do. There, she had a briefcase
with her. I don't think we still know what kind of attorney Melanie is. Yeah. I think they just see her as lawyer. So please fix all situations.
What was it? She speaks all access powers.
All access powers.
Yeah. Hours later, I noticed that Melanie still had her gloves on in the police station.
It must be cold there.
She never took them off.
And I wouldn't want to touch anything in a police station anyway. So
true. They find out that the bail is $5,000. So quick, let's go to Babylon and find $5,000. This is where the story fell apart.
Like a Batman transition from like the 60s version.
To Babylon. Like, let's go. So this was just ridiculous. They get to Babylon. Brian explains that he can't open the bank. Michael explains that he can only get $500 from an ATM. Dr. David just busts out, I can cover it with a check. Sorry, your check's not certified. Wait, I know. Blake's dealer knows a guy with $5,000. Let's call him.
I will give you this. I didn't quite track how this worked out, but it almost seemed like this is going to be just a dramatic ploy so that Blake can earn the trust of these guys, which is exactly what it does.
Totally.
And it makes Michael apologize because it gets Vic out of jail. But
they hugged.
Right. And what to me, it's like, what is Blake gonna have to do to pay off that $5,000 or something like that? That's what was going through my mind. Yeah. Is that I feel like he's gonna have to do something for that dealer. Like I couldn't quite figure that bit out.
It was super shallow. Especially because you don't call you don't run to Babylon to find your friends, to find the ex-crystal user, to get his dealer to call a guy to put up $5,000. There's a bail bondsman in the jail that will put this up for you on a bond. I read about this.
Okay.
So this was just silly. And Melanie served absolutely no purpose in the story. She did nothing. She just kind of ran along with them carrying her little leather briefcase just remember, with her gloves
she had,
on.
I mean, they had to make sure she was in the episode somehow. Yeah. And like Lindsay's like hardly in it. She just makes one little crack about Vic, like why would they arrest him if he wasn't doing anything? That
right.
Kind of, and like that's kind of all she gets.
Debbie goes through the roof for that one. So the King of Babylon contest is over. Vic is bailed out of jail by the drug dealer's friend. And Melanie, I guess, is back into bed after doing nothing. It's breakfast at the diner. Justin's there, of course. Everyone's taking a shot at Brian. And once again, it's the line up and take a punch moment.
Oh, but this one was so good.
So Justin's the new King of Babylon.
So the cub caught the lion's prey.
So, even though you'd like to rest on your laurels, secure in your position of power, now you know they're snapping at your heels, and you're going to have to run faster and faster.
So why don't you pass the fucking sugar?
You should be proud of it. Like father, like son.
I was okay with this being an episode of knocking Brian down a peg.
I did like when Justin arrived in the diner and everybody applauded.
Long live the king.
Hail to the king.
What a night.
So how was he?
He had the greatest ass. I brought him back. I fucked him all night. I think my dick's gonna be sore for a week.
That's enough.
Actually, I'd like to hear more. Speak slowly and enunciate.
He gave great head. He wanted me to fuck him with my crown on. It's kind of kinky. After a while, though, he got really clingy. He wanted to know when he could see me again.
So what'd you tell him?
I told him that he could see me in his dreams.
Justin threw back that line that we heard Brian tell him in, was it episode one?
Yes.
You can see me in your dreams. So the circle had come fully around to where Justin is now able to carry out a lot of the things that Brian used to be able to carry out.
The student has surpassed the master.
Yeah. So that's the end of this crazy episode. So our question, does it still hold up? I'm going to say mostly. Vic's arrest is more uncommon in the U.S. these days, but globally there are still plenty of countries that do far more than that, than just arresting people. The rest of the episode is still valid, I think. The themes of jealousy and those brief relationships are still around. The notion that somebody can fix a drug addict, though, is always going to be around, so the Blake and Ted arc is still relevant, I don't know. I just thought this just played out a little bit weird. So I'm going to just give this episode a mostly holds up. I'm always doing fractions.
I'm going to sort of give this a fractured yes as well. I think what really sort of saved the episode for me was that stylized way of talking about how quickly relationships can form and fall apart with Emmett's storyline. It was such a highlight for me to sort of watch. Like, I feel like that's how relationships get formed nowadays, is that people can attach themselves very quickly, and then just as quickly as they come together, just they fall apart just as quickly. So with that, as well as all of these discussions of jealousy and once again, the generational difference between Dr. David Cameron and Michael continuing on, I feel like that's also a big thing in terms of the younger, older relationships and how those differences can either strengthen or weaken a relationship, or definitely still prevalent. So I lean to yes on this one.
I like the episode. It was not a whole lot of heavy lifting going on, so it was fun. This has been episode 20, The King of Babylon.
Yeah, we have 2 episodes left this season. Join us next week for number 21, Running to Stand Still.
Until then, I am Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Thanks for listening. Leave a like, share with a friend, and subscribe so you don't miss our next episode. Still, Queer as Folk was written and performed by Patrick Randall and Matt Dominguez. Made with love in Chicago.
Hey, Todd, how's it going?
Fine.